Did you know that your medical school application GPA will likely not be the same as your transcript GPA? There are lots of reasons for that, and it can be frustrating, but there is a free, easy way to calculate your medical school application GPA at mapped.com. That's MAPPD.com. Using Mapped app, which is now free to use for a GPA calculator, this is a new change. So if you've checked out Mapped before, if it's been a while, go check it out. We've come a long way with Mapped app. And now with our free tier, after your 30-day free trial, using the referral code 30 days free, that's all one word, all capital letters, 30, the number 30 days free. After that free trial of using all of the amazing features inside of Mapped, you can now continue to use Mapped for free. Again, that's mapped.com, MAPPD.com. The pre-med year, session number 427. Hello, and welcome to The Pre-Med Years, where we believe that collaboration, not competition, is key to your success. I'm your host, Dr. Ryan Gray, and in this podcast, we share with you stories, encouragement, and information that you need to know to help guide you on your path to becoming a physician. Thank you so much for joining me today. Welcome to The Pre-Med Years. If this is your first time joining us today, we have a great podcast in store for you. I have an amazing conversation with a friend of mine who I've been friends with for a few years, who is now a director of admissions at a new medical school. We're going to talk all about that. If you're not here for the first time and you've been listening for a while, thank you for taking the time to come back to listen to hopefully help improve your journey to medical school. I'm doing a big push that I'd love to get some help from you with, and that's subscribing to my YouTube channel. I've been doing a lot of videos on YouTube, some application renovation, mission accepted. Ask Dr. Gray is on my YouTube channel as well as some other videos that come out. Go to premed.tv, subscribe if you haven't already, and I'm keeping track of who's subscribing by the end of the month. And we're going to do a little bit of a giveaway for Application Academy spot. So go to premed.tv, subscribe to that channel. Let's see if we can get some more people to notice everything that's going on over at premed.tv. All right, so today we're going to have an amazing conversation with someone who had been a pre-med advisor for 8 years and got the opportunity to be called up to the big leagues, so to speak. She's now director of admissions at NORDA College of Osteopathic Medicine, which is one of the newest medical schools in the country. It's an osteopathic medical school in Utah. And we're going to talk all about kind of her journey into being a pre-med advisor, what she saw from a pre-med side of things that completely kind of changed her mind now that she's on the medical school side of things. We're going to talk about what it's like to be a new medical school and setting that up and choosing how to pick students and admit the students that you want for your school, and just so much behind the scenes information about what is going on at NORDA College of Osteopathic Medicine. These are the kinds of conversations that I love, these behind-the-scenes looks at a medical school, because it really helps remove some of the secrecy around the admissions process. So I hope you enjoy this episode with Kristen Anderson. Kristen Anderson, welcome to the pre-med years. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
I'm excited to have you on. You and I have been friends for a while and love talking shop about the pre-med world and the medical school world. You come from the undergrad side of things, having been a pre-health advisor, pre-med advisor for a long time. And now you've crossed over to the dark side and are a director of admissions at a medical school now. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
I'm excited to talk to you about new medical schools, because where you are a director of admissions at NORDA College of Osteopathic Medicine, it's a new medical school. And there seem to be more and more opening up, and there's always lots of questions around what does that look like and what should students be thinking about. and all of that fun stuff. Before we jump into that, though, I'd love to just pick your brain about having been on both sides now, or being on both sides now, some of the things that you've seen on both sides. But I want to start with your journey as a pre-health advisor. How did you get into pre-health advising in the first place?
Completely by accident. So I actually have a master's of social work degree and worked as a therapist for a few years out of grad school before I realized that I was a little bit too sensitive for that, that the overdoses and the relapses and the suicides were a little bit too much for my psyche. And so I went into grad school knowing that that's what I wanted to do. So I had, after a few years, I was like, oh crap, now what? And so I did some soul searching, and my mom actually worked at the university that I ended up working at for a long time. I grew up on that campus. It was my own undergrad university. Mm. So when it was time to make some career changes, I started looking into options at the undergrad institution and landed completely by accident into pre-med advising. Actually, when I applied for the job, I didn't even know what a pre-med advisor was. Luckily, my boss just thought that my counseling background was enough and that I could learn kind of the nuances of you know, actual pre-med advising. And I actually have used my counseling skills quite a bit working with pre-med. So it was a nice transition.
And how long were you a pre-med advisor?
8 years.
8 years. In your 8 years as a pre-med advisor, going from not knowing anything about what a pre-med is and what that path looks like to now being a director of admissions, supposedly knowing everything there is to know, what in your mind makes someone a successful pre-med student?
I think it comes down to authenticity, being themselves, and doing the things, finding the activities, the experiences that show who they are and that, you know, help them shine. And that, I mean, working with students on both sides, I have found that to be true now. Like now I see that on the admissions side, that everything I told my students about being authentic, it makes a difference that we see it on the admissions side. And that's what helps students stand out. Is, you know, being true to themselves.
It's funny. So obviously it's a big philosophy that I have about being true to yourself, telling your story and not trying to be the best researcher, have the most hours of clinical experience, because that's how most students try to stand out, is they just try to look at what the MSAR says is a good student for a medical school, and they try to just multiply that by 10 and go, well, if I have a better GPA, if I have a better MCAT score, if I have more hours, then obviously I'm better than, and you should accept me. Why does that not work?
Well, because one, it's not authentic, and schools see through it. You can see if someone's just checking boxes and just trying to get more hours, and it comes through in how they talk about it and how they write about it. And more isn't always better. You know, if you're just cranking out hours, you might not be getting a lot out of that experience if you're just trying to get hours to get hours. Yeah. And like I said, it comes through.
What does that look like on an application? How does that come through? Being authentic, how does that come through?
How does being authentic come through?
Yeah.
That's hard to...
It is hard.
put into words. It just does. So I'm thinking about some of the applicants that I've reviewed recently, and their authenticity came through, and just they had different experiences, but you could tell in the way that they wrote about them and the way that they talked about them in both their secondary application. So we do a video for our secondary applications. And then in their interviews, it just, those things came through as just, that's who they are, you know, and it that felt different than those who seems like they're just saying the things that, you know, schools want to hear. Mm. It's really hard to put into words what that looks like.
Yeah, it is hard. And that's why it's hard when I've, the books that I've written, right, telling these telling these stories and giving these examples, I always fear like I'm giving too many examples because students just take those and go, well, I'm just going to rephrase this and now it's mine and it's different. And I'm like, no, it still doesn't work. You still have to tell your own story and come at it from your own point of view and your own upbringing and morals and ethics and everything else on how you talk about everything. So it's definitely a struggle. Now that you are on the other side of things, on the medical school side of things, having been a pre-med advisor for 8 years, what is something that you maybe were always annoyed about the medical school admissions process that you're like, oh, now I get it?
There are quite a few things, but there, lack of communication sometimes, kind of that hurry up and wait and then wait and wait some more and not hear anything. Sitting with my students, you know, my advisees who were just wondering and waiting. And, you know, I always told them, well, I imagine they're really busy. They probably have a lot of applications that they're going through and, you know, so just be patient. And now I'm on the other side and I'm like, okay, totally get it now. And we've tried really hard to be, you know, as transparent as we can with where we're at in the process and kind of getting out as much as communication as we can. Mm-hmm. But it's it's busy.
Yeah.
It's insanely busy.
Yeah. Take a normal email inbox and now multiply it by thousands. Like that's the medical school admissions inbox and communication channel.
Yes.
It's funny that that's the one you come up with because literally this weekend I was getting ready to tweet something just because I just see this all the time in my Facebook group and everywhere else, students being frustrated by this. Like I submitted 40 applications. I've heard from 5 schools. What the heck is going on? And so I was going to tweet something about it because in my mind, I'm a huge tech nerd. I love automation. Like there are very easy ways. They're complicated, but they're easy. Easy ways to add some automation into communication from medical schools that are triggered on different kind of like time periods and say every 10 days, send an email and based on where the student's file is in our system or whatever, send them a different message or whatever that may be. So that kind of stuff is possible. I'd love to see that kind of stuff from medical schools in the future moving forward because this process gets more and more expensive, it's almost a customer service kind of perspective that students have. Like I'm sitting here paying you all this money. Like just tell me something. Say hello. I don't know. It's hard, definitely. What is something so flipping it around a little bit, what is something that annoyed you as a pre-med advisor that now as a director of admissions, you're like, most schools don't need to do that. Annoying this thing that's annoying to a lot of students and a lot of pre-med advisors. Now being at a medical school, I don't understand why the other schools are doing this.
That's a good question. I would say something that annoyed me as an advisor. So like the canned, so as an advisor, one thing that really bothered me was when I would try to find out from admissions folks, like what really makes a good applicant to your school. And I got like the same canned answers from everyone.
Yeah.
And yes, we're all looking for the same ish student, mm-hmm. but I think that every school is looking for something a little bit different and that maybe we all could work on, you know, letting in a little bit on those nuances.
Yeah.
That, because seriously, it was always, oh, we're looking for, you know, good service experience, shadowing experience, healthcare yeah. experience. And I'm like, yes, but give me more, like, give me something that I can yeah. tell them. And yeah.
Yeah. So. Something that I talk about all the time, right, is fit to the school. And mm-hmm. and if schools don't tell me anything other than the generic, like, we want to serve the underserved, but great. Welcome to the 21st century in every other medical school. So it's very interesting. So at some point, obviously, you go from being a pre-med advisor to getting a job, being hired as the director of admissions at Norda College of Osteopathic Medicine. Brand new school, just getting preliminary accreditation to start accepting its first class. I want to kind of go behind the scenes. It's something that I've always loved doing with people in your position, is really going behind the scenes, trying to remove some of the secrecy about some of this stuff. As you come together as a unit, as this kind of new administration at a school, what are the things that you are all talking about to say, here's who I want at our school, right? What you were just talking about. What makes a good student for Norda College of Osteopathic Medicine?
So we're really looking for those students with kind of like that trailblazer spirit, especially for our inaugural class, because they are going to lay the foundation for years to come. That, you know, they're going to kind of set the stage for what our community will look and feel like and within the school. And we want to make sure that that, you know, starts off strong. Our curriculum it's a little bit different or a lot bit different from a lot of schools. So we're really looking for students that that can really dig in but can roll with the punches too, because for some students are going to be pushed outside of their comfort zone a lot, because we're not doing scheduled classes with, you know, large lectures. And for some students, that's going to be a big change, and being able to adjust to that is important. But first and foremost, we're looking for students with the servant's heart, that they have that genuine desire to serve others. Our mission is to help provide healthcare to the Intermountain West, which is currently lacking in, you know, physicians on a number of areas, and Utah is not ranked very high. In fact, we're very, very low in a lot of areas, 50th in the nation for female physicians. Wow. And I think 49th or really low for primary care and surgery. So, we're looking for students to help us fulfill that mission too, you know, to help get services out to, yes, it's the underserved, but it's, you know, in our service area ideally, but, you know, wherever they feel called to serve ultimately.
Yeah. Very interesting. I want to talk about curriculum since you brought that up. How does the administration come together and say, okay, we have traditional curriculum at some medical schools. Some medical schools have a lot of problem-based learning. Some have these system-based curriculums. How do you come together and say, this is what we want to do at our school?
So that's a good question. That was done before my time. But I know that our founding dean, Dr. John Doherty, he is the one that's kind of headed this kind of change in curriculum. And he tells the story of watching his own son working on a project for his master's, or writing a paper for his master's program, while FaceTiming a friend and also playing a game and like all at the same time. And he says that he found that in that moment that he was like, we've got to change how we're teaching these kids, that it, you know, it's what we've always done isn't going to necessarily work for this generation. Mm-hmm. So what we're doing, our curriculum is based on, so they're doing like bite-sized chunks basically. So you'll have content areas and like a 7-minute video that covers that content area, working in small groups or pods, learning pods. Mm-hmm. And then there will be board style questions at the end of each chunk, each core curriculum piece. And then they'll work through those together. And it just lends to, you know, better learning. So those that are early birds can do, you know, find a learning pod that everyone they're all early birds and they can learn and study together. And then those who are night owls can learn and study together. And it also will lend to a better balance, we believe, a school life balance, and allow, you know, so if you want to get in and do all of your curriculum and all your work and get your labs in the morning and then go hit the slopes in the afternoon, you can do that. So, or if you want to hit the slopes first thing in the morning and do all your work in the afternoon, you can do that. You know, or go for a morning hike or whatever, because wellness is also in built into our curriculum.
Yeah.
And not just in words, like it's really built into the curriculum. So they students could be in the middle of a really challenging content piece going through a video, you know, on say biochemistry, for example, that we know is going to be really hard. And then all of a sudden they're going to have a wellness module that comes up and is going to have them, you know, maybe meditate or something like that. So
that's not bad.
Yeah. 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 We're all really passionate about mental health and making sure that students leave medical school as happy and healthy as they started. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But sometimes that doesn't always happen, that medical school can leave people feeling pretty cynical and beaten down.
Yeah. As a new medical school accepting your first class, I know because there's been a lot of new schools recently, the question always comes up from students applying is there a risk in applying to a new school? What's going to happen? Does this look bad based on residency spots, et cetera? How do you overcome those questions and those fears in the applicants' minds?
So first and foremost, every school was a new school at some point. Every school had their first class at some point. Yeah. and they've ended up okay. In my experience, and I can't speak for forever, but in my 8 years, I've seen a lot of medical schools open up, and I have yet to see one that doesn't get accreditation. Mm-hmm. I mean, the process to get to the point where we can even accept students is so extensive, and things have to be laid out that it might feel like a risk, but there's really not that big of a risk involved because the accrediting bodies have the students' backs. You know, they have everyone's back. They aren't going to let us get to that point and then not let us grant degrees. And actually, we're required to have money in escrow that if, God forbid, something did happen, that money would be used to pay for the remainder of our students' medical education if for some reason we did not get accreditation. Wow. So it's really pretty risk-free for the students in that regard. Now, with regard to like residency placement, obviously we don't have board score, you know, history. We don't have residency placement history, but we do have some really strong things in place, I think, that will help students to place, mm-hmm. you know, do well on their boards and place really well into residency.
With USMLE Step 1, since you've just brought up board scores, with Step 1 announcing that they're going to go pass-fail and Comlex recently announcing that Level 1 is going to go pass-fail, what changes have been implemented or thoughts about changes have been discussed based on the curriculum and everything else, that the score that a student needs isn't as important anymore, at least for Level 1 or Step 1?
So that's where we're going to make sure that we have our students have ample opportunities to get research. Research is actually built into the curriculum. Mm-hmm. That's a really big piece for a lot of residency programs, is having that research experience. And our plan is to have every student leave with at least one publication, if not multiple. We will have some unique experiences with our clinical rotation. So the students will do a 6-week rotation. The first week will actually be on campus. So if they're going to go out on, say, an OB rotation, they're actually going to, with simulation and everything on campus, go through like an OB section. So they'll learn, you know, practice helping to deliver a baby, so that when they go and actually see that for the first time, in
they won't
in person,
be as useless.
They're not going to be exactly. But actually, our students are going to be scribes by their second year as well, so that they are going to be more useful once they go out into the clinics.
How is that built into the curriculum?
So they, through the first year, they will do the scribe training and certification, so that then by the second year, they can opt to go and do scribe. So if they say they're interested in orthopedic surgery, they want to go and, you know, check that out, they could go and scribe for an orthopedic surgeon, get some experience. And then by the time that they're actually doing their clinical rotations, they've already, you know, wow, kind of got their feet wet. So
that's interesting. Are you doing that on your own or through a third party, like a nationwide company like Scribe America? How are you doing that?
I believe it's on our own. Wow. That's out of my wheelhouse. So I don't know entirely all the finite details. But
yeah. See, that's the perfect example. You, as part of the administration, director of admissions, right? It's a very core piece of the curriculum that you're just like, that's not my place. And it's always the thing where I tell students, like, be careful asking very pointed, very specific questions in your interviews, because not everyone knows everything. And it's hard to get to a point in your interview and the interviewer is like, I don't know. You have any other questions? I don't know. It kind of stops the interview a little dead in its tracks. Well, that's awesome. A lot of training, looking at the student, helping them get some better training, so they're not useless, right? And I say that in a loving way, because I used to be useless too. On every start of every new rotation, you're just useless. You're like, I don't know what to do. And so that's awesome. And then being a scribe, I think it's really cool, because again, it helps open up some doors potentially to these rotations and specialties that you may want to do. Talk about the process as you're going through getting your preliminary accreditation. You get to this point where you open up for interviews. How are you training interviewers to say, here's what we're looking for? Do you, specifically for your school, obviously, are you giving a set list of questions to interviewers? Are you saying, here are the things that we're looking for, go have great conversations and come back to us? What does that training look like?
So we have an in-house training that my team and myself built, and then I developed the QBank. So we do have a set of questions that we encourage our interviewers to go off of, and they are divided into key areas, and they aren't, you know, ask these 10 questions every single time. We have a few questions for every kind of question area, and then those correspond with our scoring rubric for interviews. So it kind of helps them assess kind of the key areas that we want to assess applicants or interviewees on to find that goodness of fit.
Yeah. I love that you brought up rubric, because I think students hear that and they go, well, what happened to holistic admissions? All you're doing is putting me in a box and giving me a score. That's not holistic. But I think a rubric, if done properly, is the epitome of holistic admissions, because you have the ability to pick apart every piece of an application, of an applicant, interview, application, et cetera, to come up with it. And yes, it does kind of come up with a score at the end, but it's a holistic look at everything possible and then puts them in some sort of rank and file. Talk about rubric. What does that look like? How do you decide what goes in a rubric, what stays out of a rubric?
So we identified kind of the key areas that would help us really assess goodness of fit. So we kind of hit those key areas and then came up with the questions that would help us to kind of identify if and how students kind of fit in those key areas. Mm-hmm. And then our rubric, we actually have the applicant or the interviewer, when they're assessing it, start with meets requirements, and then moving kind of, and we have a Likert scale on each of the areas, and then kind of assessing, are they exceeding expectations there, or are they, you know, maybe falling below? And so then that way everyone kind of starts out meeting expectations unless they do something or say something that, you know, raises concerns.
Yeah.
And that is by design, that we don't want to trick students. We don't want to stress them out. We really want to have a friendly conversation so that we can assess, are they a good fit? I know there are a lot of schools out there that really just try to scare the crap out of students to see how they handle stress.
Yeah.
Which, you know, one could argue maybe would be helpful, but we just don't think that that's the best way to approach it, that we really want to know, who are these applicants and are they a good fit for us?
Yeah.
And so that's kind of where how the rubric was designed to really, you know, kind of assess that.
Yeah. Something I talk about all the time is that typically if you have the interview, and acceptance is kind of yours to lose. And it sounds like you're starting at that expectation, right? We like you, we want you, don't screw up. And obviously we're going to interview more people than we can accept, but that's just the nature of the game. How do you reassure students that you're not interviewing them for goodwill, that you really do like them and potentially want to see them at your school?
So all of our interview sessions this year, we've been totally virtual, but all of our interview sessions open with a welcome and a short message from our dean. And he reinforces that and, you know, and says that, just lets them know that they've gotten to this point because we've seen something in their application, that we're not just, you know, willy-nilly throwing out interview invitations, that we've reviewed the primary application, we've reviewed the secondary application, and there's something in their application that, you know, called our attention to them, that they might be a good fit. And now we're looking to assess that even further.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
You mentioned earlier that you've chosen to do a video interview for your secondary. It's becoming more and more common, the AAMC now releasing the VITA, kind of virtual interview tool. Why go down that route versus secondary essays like most schools?
Because we really wanted to have an opportunity to get to know our applicants better. And we didn't feel like having them write yet another essay, which I know that they recycle and reuse and swap out the names, because I advised my students to do that when I was an advisor. You know, you have to work smarter, not harder, when you're cranking out a ton of essays. Yeah. But we really wanted to get a feel for, you know, who they are, and felt like a video would lend to that much better than another essay. Also, with our curriculum, students have to be comfortable with technology. Mm-hmm. And so if they, you know, struggled with the technology of even recording a simple video, then our curriculum in our school might not be a good fit for them.
How do you prevent bias from that process? Because a video seems like it may introduce more bias, whether someone has a speech impediment, maybe someone who's reviewing a video doesn't like the high pitch or low pitch voice, somebody who is fat phobic and an applicant is overweight or black, brown, or something different. How do you overcome bias in that situation?
So whenever we have any kind of low scoring videos, they are either watched by one other person or by our entire video reviewing team. So nobody is like screened out, or we don't move beyond someone without somebody else or a group of people having a look at that video. And there are some that, you know, that I say, yeah, someone probably ought to double check me on this one. And my team does the same, you know, with ones that they watch. Cause like it or not, we all have biases, and yeah, there are times when you have that, I'm just not feeling this person, or they're kind of annoying me the way that they're, you know, talking about this or whatever. Yeah. And so I know that, and we all know to check ourselves and say, yeah, someone else better, you know, take a look at this one. Yeah. And if there are ever discrepancies when we have two people looking, then it'll go to the whole group and we will reach a consensus.
You all are accepting 90 students for your first class. And a little bit more than doubling that for a final class tally eventually. How do you decide, outside of kind of like the general trendsetter type person that you mentioned earlier, how do you decide kind of the culture of the class and what does that look like and how you're building the class over time through the application cycle?
So when we're looking at applicants, we're looking for and looking at how each potential accepted student could make their class better. That what do they bring to the table? What experiences do they have? What backgrounds do they come from? Because we believe that diversity in experience and backgrounds and, you know, where they grew up and everything, that just enriches their education that much more. So we're really looking to have a good, diverse class that may all make one another better for having gone to school with the others. If that makes sense.
It makes complete sense. It's something I talk about all the time. I teach students when asked about diversity, when asked about why should we accept you type questions, to in your mind frame that around what am I going to bring to add to the educational environment of my classmates. And it's not necessarily diversity from skin color or ethnicity, et cetera, but really my experiences, my path in life, how am I going to add to those around me?
So totally.
Makes complete sense. Awesome. Having gotten to this point, right, director of admissions, what do you see as a potential in the medical admissions world that you'd love to see change? Maybe you kind of directing that change in the future.
I would love to see medical admissions as a whole really truly become holistic in review. And that's one of the things that drew me to NORDA and why I was interested in becoming the director of admissions was that we really, truly are doing the holistic review, that we've accepted students that may not have gotten acceptances anywhere else. And it's because we look beyond the GPA, we look beyond the MCAT score. And if that were not the case at NORDA, I would not have come to work here. But I've seen too many people as an advisor, too many of my advisees who maybe, quote unquote, shouldn't have made it, who have made it and they've thrived. And I believe they're going to be some of the best physicians out there because, you know, they have that heart. Yeah. And they've put in the hard work and, you know, they fought for it. They want to be there. So
how do you balance that with the fact that students are paying a lot of money to go to medical school and there are hurdles that they have to overcome at every step of the way, and you as a school are being evaluated based on pass rates and students getting through in 4 years? How do you balance all of that to make sure that you are taking quote-unquote risks on these students who maybe don't have the best GPAs, don't have the best MCAT scores? How do you balance that with the fact that they still need to get through your curriculum and pass the boards and pass even in residency all the tests that they're going to have to take?
Sure. And that one, it's a fine line that you have to walk, but I believe that with our curriculum and the way that it's set up, so every student will have docents and advisors who will check up on them if they're, you know, falling behind, and students who are struggling will be required to attend review sessions, and they won't be like repeating lectures or anything like that. It'll be open discussion and talking about the areas that folks are struggling with. So I think having that extra support and with our unique curriculum, I think will help that, you know, help those students along. We'll have the learning specialists by their side, the docents by their side, and helping them through. But yeah, it is a fine line that you have to walk, and, you know, you have to, we look at, you know, improvement over time. So we do weigh pretty heavily the last 60 credits. So looking at you know, that upward trend that you always talk about, demonstrating that upward trend and showing that you can, you know, handle a tough load and show improvement over time. So we do look at that. But yeah, that it is a fine line to walk.
Yeah.
But ultimately too, it's, you know, students have to be willing to dig in and do the work.
Yeah.
Too. So.
Is that 60 credits undergrad, master's combined? Doesn't matter.
Yes. Doesn't matter.
Nice. Very cool. As you are there again, I love just watching you go through this whole journey as well, from pre-med advisor to director of admissions. Obviously this year, this cycle, just thrown for a loop because of COVID and just completely changing everything going virtual in terms of interviews. When it came to deciding for your first class, if you were going to make the MCAT not mandatory or anything else, how did you all decide on what you were going to do about the MCAT this cycle?
We looked at just kind of what the reality of the situation is, and that, and actually about 98% of our applicants do have MCAT scores.
Wow.
So, the vast majority have been able to sit for the MCAT. But we did look at, you know, how do we assess that, and what if they can't? We do have a waiver option for students that can demonstrate that they were not able to sit for the MCAT, because it was canceled, or because they got sick, or they were caring for a family member that got sick, or they, you know, financial constraints related to, you know, job loss due to COVID, that sort of thing. And so those were the things. And we understand everyone is this year, this, you know, 2020, this pandemic rocked everyone. And we get it. And we, you know, want to err on the side of compassion and understanding to the extent that we can. But having an MCAT score definitely does help us make some decisions, frankly. I mean, or some standardized test scores, ACT, SAT even can be helpful. But, you know, that's kind of what we looked at.
Do you see a future of medical school admissions without an MCAT?
I don't know that I do. I'd like to say that I do.
Come on!
If it were up to me, yes.
Yeah.
But I think that if it happens, it's a long time from now, because I think the schools have gotten too used to having the scores and you have to have something to assess. We have to make sure that students can, you know, take standardized tests and do at least decently well, or, you know, you do them a disservice.
Yeah.
They can't ever pass boards.
Yeah. That makes sense. What are some just complete red flags, like hard stop, hard no things that you've seen in an application, that you've seen or heard in the interview process now that you're on the medical school side of things?
Hard stop. So there are definitely some legal charges that for us are hard stops, just given where our clinical rotation sites are and their limitations. Of course, we understand that people can change and, you know, the past doesn't always predict future behavior, but we've had to unfortunately say sorry, but we can't move forward with some students that, you know, had otherwise strong applications just because we could not get them into the hospitals to do rotations.
Yeah. And that's, and that maybe is specific to NORDA, not every medical school.
Yeah. I've worked with plenty of students as an advisor who had some of the same charges that did go on to medical school and residency, and they did just fine. But that's just kind of what we're dealing with.
Yeah.
Other red flags. I feel like it's all the typical ones. I'm trying to think if there's anything kind of outside the box that stands out. I'm drawing a blank right now.
Yeah, that's okay. So talk about institutional action, because those come up, I think, the most for students reaching out saying, this happened. I recently just had a mom reach out to me saying, oh my gosh, my son being at home, like worked together with a partner and supposedly that he wasn't supposed to do that and now has an institutional action for cheating. And like, how are you reviewing those and determining this person has moved on or this may be an issue?
So, obviously all we can go off of is what is written on the application. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at, I mean, there are some institutional actions that raise, you know, bigger concerns than others. But for me, when reviewing them, it comes down to, has this person taken ownership of their role in whatever happened? Even if they feel like they were, you know, unfairly accused and they didn't believe that they did whatever. But can they at least take some ownership in how that even raised a question or how that, you know, even was a possibility to be accused, and then showing how what they've learned from that experience. That goes a long way, I think, demonstrating that they've learned, they've grown, they act and operate differently as a result of that experience. I think that's really important.
Yeah. I had a student once give me an example. He was asking for feedback. He said his institutional action description started out, I was falsely accused of. I'm like, no.
No.
Don't start out like that. You don't want to do that. Where can students find out more about NORDA College of Osteopathic Medicine?
So on our website, which is nordacom.org, and then on the Choose DO Explorer, we have a page there as well, where all of the osteopathic medical schools have information.
Nice. So, yeah. What are your final words of wisdom for the pre-med student out there who's doubting their journey, doubting their ability to get into medical school? Now, with all of your expertise on both sides of the admissions world, what kind of final words do you want to leave them with?
I would say when there's a will and a lot of really hard work, there's a way. That if this is your passion, if this is what you feel called to do, find a way to make it happen. And it might not happen on your terms or in the timeline that you would prefer, but if you put in the hard work and you keep pushing forward, I believe everyone can find a way to achieve their dreams.
All right, so there you go. Again, Kristen Anderson of NORDA, College of Osteopathic Medicine. If you want to find out more, go to nordacom.org. That's nordacom.org. And go find out how you can apply to their medical school in an upcoming cycle. I hope you got a lot of great information out of this podcast. I wanted to bring Kristen on because of her amazing dedication to her students and what she's doing at NORDA College of Osteopathic Medicine. And I kind of knew that she aligned with a lot of my philosophies on telling stories and being authentic. And if that's something that resonates with you and you haven't picked up my books yet, go check them out all at premedplaybook.com. That'll take you to my Amazon account or Amazon page that has all of my books. As I'm recording this, as this episode comes out, I will be on a call with my publisher for my fourth book, which is all about the application process. So more to come with the whole pre-med playbook series. Again, I hope this was helpful. I hope you have a wonderful week. We'll see you next time here on The Pre-Med Years.
This is MedEd Media.